A live debate of Seattle's mayoral candidates is about to begin. Let us join TVW for the latest coverage of the Seattle mayoral debate between current City Council President Lorena Gonzalez and former Council President Bruce Harrell. This is sponsored by the Washington State Debate Coalition from the Cascade Public Media Studios on the grounds of Seattle Center. This debate will focus on the economy and on business, and will be moderated by Channel 4 anchor Mary Nam. You will be able to hear the last 2 hours of Jack Stein on Cairo Nights after the 8 p.m. newscast. So now let's go live to the debate.
Taking the stage. Thanks for joining us for this King 5 News special presentation. I'm Joyce Taylor. Lorena Gonzalez and Bruce Harrell will square off live tonight in the first of two debates leading up to Election Day. Whoever wins will be busy on day one, dealing with the pandemic, the future of law enforcement, and our homeless crisis. Tonight's debate will focus on business and the economy. King 5 News chief political reporter Chris Daniels is one of the panelists tonight, and that debate is just moments from getting underway. Let's listen in.
Welcome to a live broadcast of the debate between the candidates who want to become the next mayor of Seattle. Tonight's debate comes to you from the studios of KCTS Channel 9 in Seattle, with a special thanks to the Seattle City Club's Washington State Debate Coalition, in partnership with TVW, the statewide public affairs network, and KCTS 9 Crosscut. We also want to acknowledge the generous support of our many media partners. And our sponsors, including AARP of Seattle, Salesforce, and Tableau.
Good evening. I'm Mary Nam with Como News, and I'll be your moderator this evening. For tonight's debate, we will focus on two specific issues, Seattle's economy and the business climate. In 2 weeks, we'll have the candidates back to debate public safety and public health policies at that time. I'm joined by three local reporters, Chris Daniels with King 5, Amy Radill with KUOW Radio, and Daniel Beekman with the Seattle Times. And we will all ask questions of the two candidates for mayor, Lorena Gonzalez and Bruce Harrell. As you watch the debate, we invite you to join the conversation on social media using the hashtag you see on your screen, hashtag WaElects. The rules this evening are simple. Each candidate will get 1 minute to answer a question with a follow-up discussion led by the questioner. But first, each candidate gets 90 seconds to introduce themselves to the audience. The order was previously determined by coin flip. Bruce Harrell won the toss and has chosen to go first. Bruce?
Thank you very much. Thanks for having this forum. I'm very excited. In 19 days or so, we'll have a newly elected person to run the city. And I will tell you that for the last 8 months, I've been talking to people in coffee shops and grocery stores and neighborhoods, walking with small businesses. They are starving for effective leadership, sort of a no-nonsense approach. They want the homelessness issue addressed with a sense of urgency. They want people out of the parks and off the sidewalks and out of tents. They want them to have warm water, and they want them to have heat. And they don't want to be demonized by saying they want the parks back, because they want them housed. And the people who want to be housed want services. We're not getting that from City Hall. We're getting finger pointing, excuse making, and I'm not seeing a sense of urgency. So I'll tell you that's the biggest issue that we're going to grapple with. But we also have to look at police reform, and people want 7-minute response times. They want an effective police department. That's why I don't subscribe to the defund narrative that my opponents and others have articulated. I want an effective police department. I want all communities to feel safe. We will remove bias. That's why I passed a bias-free policing law. We will look at the race issues and unreasonable force, but make no mistake about this. I want all communities to be safe. And small business revitalization, I've toured all over the city talking about how the city could remove impediments to their progress, their optimization. So I'm excited about this new level of leadership, this new tenacity, if you will, and I think that's why we've been doing so well on the campaign trail, and I look forward to your questions this evening.
Bruce, thank you. Your time is up. Lorena?
I was born and raised in Central Washington State, where I earned my first paycheck at the age of 8 as a migrant farm worker. I did that alongside my parents and my siblings. I am a really proud first-generation American who went to community college, and then I worked three jobs to put myself through college. I moved to Seattle almost 20 years ago to go to law school, and before becoming the first Latina to be elected citywide in Seattle's history, I was a civil rights attorney. I have made it my life's work to stand up and fight for working families. Whether it's taking on a large corporation who's engaging in discrimination or holding police departments, including SPD, accountable for the extraordinary abuse of our life and liberty, this is the hard work that I have done all my life. As a parent, like so many of you, I know that we are at a critical crossroads. Will we be a city that is only accessible and available to the wealthy who can afford million-dollar homes? Or will we be a city that is inviting and welcoming to families of all incomes, where every neighborhood is a good one to live in and safe? You know, just a few months ago, I lost my mother-in-law and my home in a tragic fire. Seattle showed me its deep generosity in that moment, and it clarified for me my motivation to serve as mayor and lift each other up through programs like affordable childcare, housing, and mental health care, rather than punching down on those who don't have as much as we do. So with your help, I will be the mayor of Seattle who will dream big, work hard, and build a Seattle that is for everyone.
Lorena, thank you very much. I'll start off the questions for the evening with a simple question. My question is, as mayor, what will be your number one priority? Please be specific. What issue as mayor will be at the top of what may be a long list? Lorena, first.
Sure. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the next mayor's biggest opportunity and challenge to lead is on solving for homelessness. Like so many people in our city, I believe that people living in our open spaces in tents is unacceptable. I do not believe that people should be living outside. We need to work clearly and urgently to rapidly increase shelter and to make sure that we are still looking at how we can build more affordable housing throughout our city and increasing access to mental health care and substance use disorder treatment throughout the city. This is the number one challenge for the city, and I'm looking forward to being able to work on those issues together with our broad community to create rapid and meaningful progress in the first 100 days of my administration.
Thank you. Bruce?
Thank you. Same issue, homelessness. I think we understand that. I guess our approach will be differently, however, will be different. I have a sense of urgency that the first thing we will do is publish a plan. You'll see cost per person, cost per unit. You'll see a dashboard of where we are now, which is totally unacceptable. A sense of urgency. And when I talk about moving people out of parks, out of sidewalks, out of playgrounds where you see syringes and these intolerable conditions, I'm talking about building and treating our way out of this issue with a sense of urgency. Under the Harrell administration, you have no excuse making. We will never reach a time where we'll say we have all of the taxes, all of the revenue to solve the problem. What we'll do under my approach is we will exhaust every possible tax we could, from looking at our regressive tax structure and making sure we increase and use and change a more progressive tax structure. Yes, there's no disagreement there. But we also have these very wealthy corporations. If we get into the economics of this city, we are a wealthy city. So we're going to also tap into the resources around us and make sure that all hands are on deck under the Harrell approach.
Thank you very much. Chris?
Well, you both danced around the wealthy corporations line. I'm going to get right to it with Amazon. As you both know, over the past 5 years, Amazon has increasingly been a point of contention at City Hall. It is the city's biggest employer. And with it, there's been a fair amount of criticism of the company over its business practices on a global scale. However, its presence in the heart of the city has led to a proliferation of small business growth, a boost in home values, and pre-pandemic traffic. So, Bruce, we're going to start with you. Given the sky is falling discussion about Amazon and their relationship with City Hall, they just announced that they're going to hire thousands more people in Seattle. And given that, what should the company do to alleviate some of the concerns that are shared as relates to housing and infrastructure?
Well, number one, they have to pay their fair share of taxes, number one. Number two, they have to align their corporate social responsibility goals with that of the city. That would be affordable housing. That would be homelessness. That will even be some of the health care initiatives that we will roll out as mayor. But let's make no mistake about that. If you look at our gross domestic product in this region, we are doing quite well. But everyone's not enjoying in that success. The market value of Amazon is about $1.56 trillion, lower than Microsoft's, actually. Microsoft's about $1.61 trillion. And these are pre-pandemic numbers. But when you look at the wealth that these corporations have, they have to not only pay their fair share of taxes, they have to be aligned with the issues, many of the issues that they've caused. So my platform has to do a lot with not only holding them accountable, but looking at these vast resources around us. Some of these companies, for example, their corporate social responsibility are race and data and inclusive efforts for their employees. And so we're going to align their efforts with the important issues here in the city of Seattle.
So I have to ask you, what's your definition of fair share?
Well, first of all, this would be governed by state law. And if you look at the 65, both former or current elected officials around this state, nationally and locally, they will work together, I believe, for the first time to really attacking the regressive taxation laws we have right now. We understand that in the state. We hear people talking about it over and over. Look what they did. The climate change laws that they passed, the 12 police reforms, the laws that they have. And I don't think it's coincidental that we have the most diverse legislature we've ever had in our state's history. That's why I say we have 65 of these regional leaders who have endorsed my candidacy, and we will look at that tax structure and revise it.
Well, I want to go to you, Lorena, because you have criticized the company in the past. Do you think it would be a good thing or a bad thing if Amazon, ultimately because of the relationship with City Hall, decides to move more employees to Bellevue or another city in the Puget Sound region?
I don't think that Amazon's going to look at moving anywhere else but here in Seattle. We just saw that they announced that there are going to be 12,500 new jobs right here in the city of Seattle. Why? Because we're a beautiful city. Their workers and their future workers want to live and work in this city. So it is critically important for us to hire, to make sure that we have a mayor who is serious about requiring all large profitable corporations pay their fair share. So let's be real about this. I'm the only candidate on this stage who means it. I am supported by working class families because they know I am serious about bringing to bear the reality of corporations paying their fair share. My opponent, on the other hand, is supported by the very people who are in court right now fighting to overturn a progressive tax on the largest, wealthiest corporations in our city. So that is a huge distinction. I'm not going to punt to the state legislature to fix our revenue problems. We have an opportunity to do that here, and we should take it.
But again, I want to ask you the question. Is it a good thing or bad thing if Amazon was to move employees to Bellevue, where they've been welcoming them, or Everett, or down in Pierce County, where the viewpoint of Amazon is different?
We want our employers to remain in the city, particularly if they are high road employers. So I'm willing to work with any employer who is willing to do the right thing by their employees, by making sure they can unionize, by making sure they have access to health care, to child care, and to transit opportunities that aren't congesting our streets, and who are going to pay their fair share to help us build the amenities that make Seattle a great and vibrant city.
Bruce, your opponent just said that your backers are trying to fight that law that's on the books. How do you respond?
You know what's the problem with that narrative, and it just doesn't seem to stick, is my opponent doesn't mention the fact that the sheet metal workers, the electrical workers, the firefighters, the bus drivers, the Washington Communication Workers of America, the Washington Council County of State employees, that's 16,000 people, they support me. She doesn't mention the fact that Gerald Hankerson, Carolyn Wiley Payne, Carl Mack, Don Mason, these social justice activists all support me, including members of the Black Caucus, in addition to congressmen and Congresswoman Marilyn Strickland. So, and she never points out what I've done to the detriment of people. My whole life I fought for underrepresented people. So that narrative just doesn't seem to stick.
Well, I'm gonna let Lorena respond to that. Lorena.
Yeah, you know, it is beyond dispute and debate who my opponent is benefiting from in this campaign. And we all know, voters know, that money talks in politics. And it is beyond refute that my opponent is benefiting from hundreds and thousands of dollars from our city's real estate developers who have gentrified our communities and have evicted our poor working families into the streets, and by Trump's top state donor. Those are the facts. Follow the money, and the money will tell you that my opponent is benefiting in this campaign from those particular corporate and moneyed interests in our city.
We'll let this subject stand there for now. Daniel Beekman from the Seattle Times.
I would like to refute some of that, because when that narrative, it's interesting that people are confused by that, because that same donor who I've never met, never talked to this person, I don't know this person, also supported Governor Jay Inslee and many Democrats as well. And so it's a false narrative, and I think the voters will be smarter than that. To blame me for people, over 5,000 people who support my campaign. We poll consistently the highest out of the 15 candidates in the primary. We won the primary out of the 15 candidates, and when I met people at Green Lake and Broadview Thompson Elementary, there were no corporations there. These are the people of Seattle that are saying, we'd like your messaging. So that narrative is a false narrative, and I think people need to call that out.
Well, since you jumped in, Bruce, we're going to let Lorena respond to that as well.
Yeah, the reality is that there are hundreds and thousands of dollars that are benefiting my opponent that come from a handful of people in this city. And they are attacking me. They're spending $200,000 attacking my policy choices. Why? Because they know that in a Harrell administration, they won't be required to pay their fair taxes. And it will continue to be business as usual. The Goodmans, the Petries of the world. This is the billionaire class in our city. And they have taken part and parcel in exacerbating income inequality in our city and in creating evictions, mass evictions of working class people just last year. So this is a reality of who my opponent is benefiting from are these billionaire class political donors, one of whom is the unrefuted top donor to the Trump campaign in 2020.
Who's right. Also we'll getting money to right Jane, Jay Inslee and others that she doesn't talk about. And in fact, that 2/3 of her money is coming from out of state. I mean, if we're going to have the narrative, let's just have the narrative.
Bruce, Lorena, hard stop.
Move on to a slightly different question
here. Thank you. Both of you have city council experience. You even share time on the council together. I want to know from each of you what you've done at City Hall to help create jobs and to help workers on the job, and how that sets you apart from your opponent. Also, what you would do as mayor in those areas. And Lorena, we'll start with you.
Great. I'm represented by just about every major labor organization in the city because they know that I am committed to centering the needs of working class families when I get to City Hall. No more catering just to the corporate interests in this city. And my number one focus will be to create a strong, vibrant local economy that, again, invites our high road employers to come into the city of Seattle and to create those union wage jobs for all of the people who want to work in this city. And so that's going to be one of my top priorities. And I'll tell you, I have been a champion on the city council advocating for better labor standards, for better wages and conditions for our hotel workers and for our restaurant and our retail workers. And that's the kind of progressive track record I'm going to build as the next mayor of this city.
Thank you. And Bruce, can you tell us about what you have done at City Hall for workers and what your priorities in that area would be as mayor, how they may differentiate you from your opponent?
Absolutely, because I didn't hear any policy solutions to helping create jobs. And make no mistake about this, coming out of the pandemic, there will be winners and losers. And the winners will be those who know how to keep, retain, and make the jobs and make sure we have an environment by which everyone can enjoy the opportunities in front of you. So what I have done in the past is work closely with our Office of Economic Development, making sure that they use a regulatory structure or market-to-market strategies, make sure businesses have a relationship with one another. But if you talk to small businesses, and I've been all around the city talking to small businesses, you have to meet them where they are. They want strong public safety. And that's when my opponent made the commitment to defund the police by 50%. She missed the mark because they want safety for their employees and for their customers, number one. Number two, I will share with you that when the government gets out the way, I do not take jobs for granted. I do not assume that any of the small, medium, or large organizations will still be here in Seattle, because if you look at the job loss that are occurring, we are driving jobs outside of Seattle. So under the Harrell administration, you will see us actually work relationships with these organizations, making sure we have small business to large business relationships. I see you giving me the nod to wrap up. But I do not take our job environment for granted by any stretch of the imagination. That's why my family said come here is for jobs.
Okay, thanks. And Lorena, you heard what your opponent has to say. He said that he didn't hear specific policy proposals from you. So how do you respond?
You know, here's the problem with my opponent's perspective in the area of jobs. He has a top-down approach. He believes that a trickle-down approach is the much better approach. OED doesn't serve workers. It serves employers. The Office of Labor Standards is a key part of how we increase better working conditions so that jobs are good jobs. And the better the jobs are, the more jobs we produce. And the more we invest in our local economy and their resilience and recovery by making sure that it is easier to do business and that they don't have to deal with the bureaucracy that the city puts in front of them, the better it will be for them to flourish in our city.
Bruce, do you want to respond to that, 30 seconds?
Just quickly, the Office of Labor Standards does not create jobs. They are doing what they should do, which is protect workers' rights. The Office of Economic Development, under our administration, will double down on their approach to make sure we are creating jobs. We will use community block grant organizations, community development, financial institutions, CDFIs, and we'll make sure that we have lending capital available for small businesses. We'll have an account system such that small businesses know exactly who in the city is responsible for them. It's too bureaucratic. So you're going to actually see an increased funding in our Office of Economic Development. You can't have jobs unless you have employers, and that's economics 101. And so while we will make sure that OLS does their charter purpose, their purpose under the ordinance, we'll make sure we're creating jobs in the right department.
Thank you.
We invited our audience to submit questions, people who are interested in this race. This came from Jan in Fremont. It's about the future of how Seattle's going to look. The question is, can you please explicitly tell us how you would be willing to change zoning regulations in single-family or neighborhood residential areas to accommodate some of our city's increasing density? And, Bruce, this goes to you for the first minute.
Absolutely. So my opponent is fond of supporting the total elimination of single-family zoning, which is just not my narrative or my approach, that I still believe we have hundreds of thousands of unused zoning capacity that we should aggressively pursue. Increased density, increased height, certainly where it makes sense, but I think this is going to be a collaborative discussion. You look at what's happening in California, you look at what's happening in Minneapolis, Minnesota, when they talking about eroding exclusionary zoning, and yes, it has its roots in discriminatory practices and racism. We understand that. But we have to work collaboratively with neighborhoods and attack zoning where it makes sense. Also, in single-family zoning, we could be very aggressive in our development of attached dwelling units and detached dwelling units having separate tax ID numbers. If we're going to build apartments, the other issue that I talk about that no one else talks about is the conversion from apartment buildings to condo ownership, because condo ownership is very difficult in this state. I've played a role in that. We are one of the most difficult states to convert. I want people to have generation wealth passed down, and that's why I'm not quick to say the total elimination of single-family zoning. This has to be a citywide discussion. We will lead it, but we're not going to come in and say we support the total elimination of single-family zoning.
Thanks. Lorena?
You know, we've been having a conversation as a city, as a society, for many, many, many years about how zoning impacts communities of color and low-income communities. Seattle, as progressive as we are not immune from the realities and the vestiges of racism that is left behind because of redlining practices. And when we look at this area, we know that the reality is that there is very little part of our city that is absorbing all of the growth in our city. And so I believe that it is important for us, in order to create a city that is not just available to the wealthy with exclusive neighborhoods and million-dollar homes, that we must reform our zoning laws to allow for more housing choice in our most attractive neighborhoods and invite more families of varying incomes into those neighborhoods to live with us and benefit from some of the prosperity that many of our low-income families and our working-class families have been excluded from precisely because of the strict nature of our existing zoning laws.
So let me ask a follow-up, and I'll bring it to both of you. But so 5 or 10 years from now, people are walking down the streets in what used to be single-family zoned neighborhoods. If you're mayor, how will those neighborhoods look? How will they be different, or how will they be the same?
You know, I think they wouldn't be the same. They would be walkable, bikeable neighborhoods where you can, you know, get to a grocery store, a daycare, or your doctor within 15-minute walk or bike ride.
How many buildings are there? Are there apartment buildings on every street, or how should that part look? How dense will they be?
You know, neighborhood planning that includes those voices who've been excluded from access to these wealthy, exclusive neighborhoods are going to guide and shape all of these decisions. But in order for that neighborhood planning to be real and to fulfill the promise of housing choice and accessibility to our currently wealthiest neighborhoods in the city, we have to allow for zoning changes to allow for that conversation to happen in the first place. So the city is going to be you know, a walkable, bikeable city that has apartments and other kinds of home ownership opportunities that aren't just limited to million-dollar homes like they are right now.
Bruce, how would you like to see this? Used to be known as single-family neighborhoods look
my
different?
My opponent strung a lot of words together, but she's not saying what she believes in. That's the total elimination of single-family zoning. I mean, simply put, that is not my vision. That I grew up in this city. I went to Seattle Public Schools here. I went to college here. You cannot tell me that every neighborhood is conducive toward having many apartment buildings in their neighborhoods. And that's why this is going to be a collaborative approach. Now, we will lead the discussion with neighborhoods, with density experts, with urban planners. But the fact of the matter is, when I look at tree canopy, I look at open space, I look at the quality of life here in Seattle, that we have to examine where it makes sense first. And when we have hundreds of thousands of unused zoning capacity, this is not a litmus test as whether you embrace density or whether you want to squeeze everyone in a city. Let's grow together and have this discussion. And I think the city wants just straight talk on these issues. And if I'm one thing, I'm just a straight talker. So when I say I don't stand for the total elimination of single-family zoning, and I've heard her at forum saying she's saying that, here in this live debate, she strings these words together, but that's not the Seattle that I envision.
I'd like to move on to an issue that you both agree is the number one issue that must be addressed in the city, which is the homeless crisis. A vibrant local economy calls for safe public spaces, so safe public clean streets, parks, public transportation, public schools, roads that we all use. And neighborhoods like Ballard, Soto, and Green Lake have recently struggled with safety issues posed by growing encampments. My question to you both is, how do you help those in crisis? And we are talking about the mentally ill, those with addiction problems. How do you help those in crisis when they refuse wraparound services, as we have seen happen time and time again? What approach moving forward will be more effective in making a real dent in solving this crisis? And I'd like to start with Bruce. Lorena, my apologies.
Sure. I believe it is unacceptable for people to be living outside. I think it's unacceptable for people to be living in encampments, and I think it's unacceptable for people to live in our parks, in our doorways, and in our greenways. And I think my opponent agrees with me to that point. But I think this is where the similarities end. My opponent has been on record saying that his approach would be to make sure there are consequences for people, for the government's failure to do our job, which is to make sure that there's a strong safety net and that we're increasing rapidly the available shelter that is unique and needed for each individual's need. I also believe that the next mayor needs to not just focus on increasing rapidly the shelter available, not just by 2,000 units, because there are 4,000 people sleeping outside tonight, but by 4,000 units, and also making sure that we are adequately resourcing mental health and always working on the sustainable approach, on the most sustaining solution to homelessness, which is affordable housing.
Thank you. Bruce?
Sure. So many of you know my wife used to be the CEO of United Way, and she and I have been in this space of homelessness and trying to help the homeless population for decades. And so to suggest that I would criminalize poverty in any way just goes against everything I've been spending my life toward. Now, we have to also talk about the face of the homeless. It's multifaceted. Certainly there are people with mental illness and drug and alcohol issues. Some people just need a job, and that's why we are creating the Seattle Job Center. The fact of the matter is there are also people in there that are engaging in sex trafficking and preying upon the other demographics. And we do have criminal laws for a reason. And so when I talk about there being consequences, two things. Number one is we have to find out why they are refusing services. Number one, only about 2% of the people do. 98% of the people are saying, I want services. I want a home. So if I could solve it by 98% of the problem, then that's pretty darn good. But I'm even concerned about that 2%. So perhaps I need culturally competent service providers. Perhaps I need someone that comes from their neighborhood or their demographic. By the way, these are people that I know out here. These are not strangers to me. So I have to figure out how to reach them. But if we're going to be honest in this city, and the next mayor has to be completely transparent and completely honest, there are also some unkind people in some of these encampments, and they are preying upon the others. And so I have to make sure everyone is safe and everyone protected. And when I say consequences, we'll treat each case on a case-by-case basis, but we can't ignore the fact that some of them are dangerous.
I think a lot of viewers and listeners want to know how you would go solve the existing problem that we see. To that end, there are homeless families, the ones that we don't see, the single moms crash couch surfing with their child, living in their cars. There are a plethora of homeless people that we don't see at the parks, and they're trying to make ends meet, and they're trying to go to work and send their kids to school. Wraparound services, housing, the need is definitely there. The people that remain at the parks, the people that live in the alleyways, as we have seen time and time again, they are mentally ill. They are bipolar, some are schizophrenic, years of drug addiction. When you present a service to them, they may not be of a mental health situation where they can understand what you were saying and accept. Again, when the parks are filled with a certain type of population who need real treatment, how do you force them to take it? And will you force them to take it? Lorena?
I think we have to be careful about crossing the line and forcibly subjecting people to treatment that they may not otherwise be ready to receive. Those policies have been tried in the past during the war on drugs and otherwise. And so let's not go back to the policies of the past that have been proven to not work. Our job as government is to build the safety net, to meet the unmet needs of individuals, and to make sure that the services that we are offering him or her, and yeah, in some instances, children living on our streets, that it is appropriate culturally and otherwise, that is an appropriate intervention to meet them where they're at and create every incentive possible to have them say yes. And that is where we're failing right now. So we can and must scale up our access to behavioral health and substance use disorder treatment. Just last week, had a meeting with over 30 behavioral health service providers in our area who are providing concrete solutions that we can put into place right now. And I'm actively pursuing those in my current role. So that's the kind of urgency we need to have. And it's the kind of collaboration we need to have from subject matter experts driving solutions, not politicians, and not people who are just functioning from a place of anger and frustration.
To that end, until they say yes, do they remain in the park?
No, I think we have to do everything we can. There's a difference between saying yes or no to behavioral health services and being able to say yes or no to shelter. Our work is to, regardless of what your substance use, addiction might be in that moment, we can still provide you a low barrier, barrier-free shelter opportunity to say you cannot stay in this park. You have to go to a more appropriate place. I've also talked to a lot of community outreach workers who say, look, we just need about 8 contacts with folks at a minimum to be able to create the incentive and a plan, a clear plan to transition people out of our parks to a more suitable place while we work on those shelter options and on the housing options. And those are the kind of trauma-informed, people-focused strategies I want to be able to support. It's going to require resources, which is why I am proposing that we pay for those resources by making sure that the wealthiest and our largest corporations in our city are paying their fair share to fund those services, not at the state, right here in the city.
Thank you very much. And Bruce, how do you respond to that? And I just want to be very clear. The question is worded this way specifically because until now, this is how the mayor's office has responded. No one is being removed until they accept shelter or until there is enough shelter space. So therefore, people who live near these encampments want to know, then do they stay put until they say yes? If that's the case, how do we get them to say yes? What is the strategy?
Well, if my opponent is saying, no, they don't stay in parks, I would agree with that. That is a far different statement that has been said thus far on the campaign. That's good. We would agree. I will also say that based on my life's work and trying to help people, that I'm confident by hiring the best mental counselors, the best social workers, making sure they are compensated. That is a tough job. And in my plan, not only do we talk about making sure people get the services, we talk about recruiting people from culturally competent areas to help do this work and looking at the bench strength using the university structures. Many of you know I serve as a trustee at Western Washington University. My wife serves as a board of regent at the University of Washington. I want to be able to have a pipeline, a competency, and this is economic development as well, because our country needs this. And so I'm also concerned about how and who treats these people who desperately need help. But the fact of the matter is I want our parks back, and I want our sidewalks back, and I want to house the people. That's my sense of urgency. And quite candidly, the whole city knows we're not seeing that coming from City Hall.
Thank you, Bruce.
May I respond to something that my opponent just said? Just really briefly, don't want to dwell on it too much. My opponent just said that I've taken a different position, somehow creating the insinuation that I want people living in parks. I've never said that. I've said I don't want people living anywhere, in any place, in any corner of our city outside. My goal is to bring people inside, to end homelessness, not just hide it, by sweeping people around and subjecting them to, in my opponent's own words, consequences for living and surviving outside.
I'd like to continue the conversation talking about shared prosperity, the differences between downtown and, say, the 98118 zip code, the most diverse zip code in the city of Seattle. Bruce, we're going to start with you. As you know, according to multiple reports and studies, minority-owned businesses receive less federal coronavirus assistance than their white counterparts. And it's fair to say that in the city of Seattle, communities of color outside downtown have felt there's never been the support from the city or the same emphasis for economic growth. How would you change that?
Well, number one, I'm very proud to be supported by so many, literally dozens and dozens of BIPOC small businesses, because I've been doing this work for a long time. And so one of the things that I bring is the relationship capital. I started a group called Performance First at the Puget Sound Regional Council, where we dealt with minority-owned businesses, introduced them to larger businesses, and said, judge us on our performance first, and that's why we called it that. So what you're going to see, again, through my Office of Economic Development, you're going to see these relationships done, and we will lead the way in terms of minority contracting. My wife was a leader at the University of Washington, making sure minority-owned businesses get their fair share of contracting. So the Seattle should lead with, in terms of port contracts, state contracts, county contracts. Seattle has the infrastructure to be on the leading edge of this kind of work, and that's what you're going to see under the Harrell administration. If you look at my website, you'll see all of these business owners looking for my leadership, and I have to tell you that we have a wide open opportunity. It was disgraceful how a lot of the BIPOC businesses, and even the smaller businesses in general, were not able to enjoy their fair share of the ARPA funds.
So a lot of people aren't surfing the web right now because they're watching this live. So what's one specific thing that your administration would do in the first 6 months if elected?
Yes. Create a roster of minority-owned businesses and then introduce those minority-owned businesses to all of the general contractors and make sure that this roster, the certification process, is not only given to the general contractors, but make sure that this is given to all of the jurisdictions around, and then we measure. We go back and measure. Tabor 100, the leaders of Tabor 100, that's the work that they do. And the leaders of Tabor 100 are warmly behind me. So you're going to see relationship capital and measurement in terms of contracts, goods, and services.
Loretta, you have campaigned on a recovery plan that you say is not downtown only, yet it's hard to dispute there are tens of thousands of jobs downtown that are tied to that engine, including restaurants, bars, clothing shops, dry cleaners. How will your plan help those small businesses that are banking on a recovery downtown?
Yeah, no, I think you know, small businesses, regardless of where their location is, are deserving of assistance and help from the city of Seattle. What I get worried about is a city hall that continues to cater to big business corporate interests in downtown only. And so my Prosperity for All plan really focuses on workers first. How do we make sure that our workforce is healthy, is being taken care of, has pathways to good jobs in our city? And we're hearing right now from many employers, particularly small business employers, who are having a heck of a time finding folks to work. Why? Because workers are making a decision to not go back to work because of poor wages, because of lack of access to health care, because of being sick of not having any real paid time off to spend with their families. So we have to figure out how we can support our local economy by making sure that we're getting money into the hands of consumers and workers, while also making sure that we are making our commercial spaces affordable and reducing our bureaucracy to make permitting and licensing much better. And the last thing I will say is that I think it is patently unfair that we live in a city in which our small businesses pay on the dollar significantly more in city taxes than our big, giant tech companies in this city. And I will look forward to being the next mayor and championing those tax reforms to make those business taxes locally much more progressive for our small business owners.
So you just said we have to figure it out, but I'll ask you the same question I asked Bruce. What do you do in the first 6 months, if elected, to change the discourse downtown and help out the small businesses downtown?
We do exactly what I just described. We assemble the task force that's going to be required, that has representatives from across every neighborhood district across the city that is representative of small businesses. There's a current small business advisory council that the current mayor instituted. I welcome the opportunity and do intend to continue to have that kind of an advisory advisory committee available to guide the work that's going to be necessary to continue to target our limited resources through ARPA and other pass-through funds to really help small businesses. And I did that in the Seattle Rescue Plan recently. We made direct assistance available to small businesses, particularly in those neighborhoods that are hardest hit, which are our neighborhood business districts and are our small businesses and are our BIPOC women-owned, LGBTQ-owned businesses in the city of Seattle.
In 30 seconds, Bruce, to give you a chance to respond, do you like that plan?
Well, it's just a lot of words strung together. I didn't hear a plan. I didn't hear an original idea. We are creating a Seattle Job Center. And in a Seattle Job Center, not only will we be able to retool people who are looking for a new job, the employers will be able to find the employees. Think of Indeed and LinkedIn and the Washington State Employment Office. Think of an economic generator where both employers and employees can get matched. And also think about grants and programs, training opportunities, apprenticeships that often pay six-figure incomes. Think about a pipeline for everyone that helps the employees and the employers. We're creating a new department called the Seattle Job Center. That's a solution.
Loretta, do you like the Seattle Job Center idea?
Well, honestly, you don't have to be mayor to stand up a Seattle Job Center. And I'm not sure that the city should be spending limited taxpayer dollars on setting up a privately funded Indeed job search. I mean, that's what Indeed and those other job search engines are designed to do, and I think they're doing it.
All right, we're going to move on to a different matter here. As Amy mentioned, we've had questions from readers and viewers. Ron from Green Lake asked what role you each see cars playing in Seattle's mobility future and its economy, which for me called to mind an ongoing debate at City Hall about how to spend revenue from new car tab fees. Some months ago, there was some debate about this. There may be more coming up. An audit last year found that only 29% of Seattle bridges were in good condition and recommended that the city start spending much more on maintenance of bridges. But there are competing demands for transportation money, like sidewalks, bike lanes, and traffic calming. Starting with you, Lorena, how would you like to see that money divvied up? And how does that reflect your priorities for transportation and infrastructure?
Yeah, I think I want to answer this question by just acknowledging that I have a very young daughter. She's a year and a half, and I worry about whether she's going to have clean air and clean water in the future. And so to me, the issues related to transit and who we're prioritizing our city for really comes down to how serious is the next mayor going to be about climate change and tackling climate change. And the next mayor is going to have to make difficult decisions about making sure that the already limited dollars that are allocated to transit stay in the pockets of transit and multimodal transportation projects that are carbon free and have no emissions associated with them, while also looking at how we're going to create, again, leverage all of those dollars to invest in greener types of transportation throughout the city. That's why I'm really proud to be the only candidate in this race who has been endorsed by every single environmental organization that's made an endorsement.
And let me just make sure, on the question of there's a pot of money coming, mm-hmm. how to apportion that between things like bridge maintenance, things like sidewalks and bike lanes and traffic calming. How do you see that breakdown?
I think that it's really important to make sure that we're investing significantly in our sidewalks and in our bike lanes and in safe ways to travel throughout the city that make cars optionals. That doesn't mean that we do not need to pay attention to bridge maintenance. We absolutely do. I live in West Seattle. I understand what it's like to have a bridge fail, a major piece of infrastructure fail in our city. But I will not be a mayor that raids transit funding in order to fund those maintenance requirements. There are other ways we can leverage bonds and other resources from the state to address those bridge maintenance issues, including our federal infrastructure.
Okay, Bruce, and same question to you. This pot of money, but also just in general, your priorities for spending on transportation.
Sure. Thanks for getting clarification on my opponent's answer. So we lead with transit. We know that our highest level of emissions are from cars, and so we will stop our reliance on cars, recognizing, however, that cars will get smaller and electrified. So we also don't ignore the fact that people will continue to drive cars. They will get smaller, though. So I don't lead with bikes. I did hear my opponent mention bikes. I think that we look at the whole ecosystem of transportation. And we start with transit. We look at our roads. We build for the future. And we have scooters and we have other types of electric devices in the city. But we also have to lead with safety, our Vision Zero lens, because our city has to be safe. So as we incorporate bike lanes and car lanes and looking at how everyone gets around in our city, we have to lead with a safety lens. And so under my priority, we will start with transit. And by the way, we have climate change experts have endorsed my climate change plans from all over the country. So we will lead with climate change as well, but we start off with transit.
And just I'm going to follow up on you as well, talking about this pot of money from the car tab fees. There's been talk at City Hall about breaking it down. 75% should go to bridge maintenance. No, 75% should go to, or 100% should go to traffic calming and safe streets efforts. So what would your breakdown be? Same question.
Because you guys were kind enough to not let us have notes up here, I actually have a breakdown on one of the position papers that I've written. But I emphasize, Dan, the entire ecosystem, because I will tell you that if you're leading with a vision zero in terms of fatalities and accidents, it's hard to put percentages on the table. I will tell you that we have to have the best of the best in our transportation planning. I mean, it has to be open. Now, one thing we will do is we'll open up the data. You'll see exactly where our money goes, and it'll be a participatory process with some of our strongest transit advocates and transportation advocates while we work through the transit master plan here in the next couple of years.
Thanks very much.
So I know you're going to be discussing public safety in depth in a couple weeks, but it was really hard to separate all the public safety out of some of the business and economic questions that we wanted to bring to you tonight. So recently, members of the Downtown Seattle Association asked the city to provide safety and security grants to small businesses to offset additional security costs. They said that this is prompted by reduced SPD staffing and increased response times. Is that idea for those security grants an idea that you would support? And Bruce, it's to you first.
Well, this is where I think my opponent misses the mark, because what small businesses are saying is they want public safety. Now, I will support anything that's working right now because I have a sense of urgency. And if that's one option and we can make that happen, that's fine. But at the end of the day, we have to have a funded police department. And the police department in the city of Seattle, they have to meet their charter purpose, which is to protect everybody and build community trust. And so that's a stopgap measure. I don't think that is sustainable. So under our approach, we'll make sure that, number one, the department is funding, and we will again eradicate bias-free policing and make sure that the bias-free policing law that I put on the books is enforced. And so, but I think that's a stopgap measure. I do not think it's sustainable.
Okay, Marina.
I think that there's two issues with that proposal. The first one being that it's probably a gift of an illegal gift of public funds, and secondly, I think that the police officers' guild might have a thing or two to say about contracting out work that is related to public safety. So again, I think that the reality is in this space is that we have got to have a mayor who is not going to make excuses for a police department that has significant operations and management issues, a police department that also has deep cultural and reform issues, a department that had the largest contingency of officers at the January 6th insurrection, a department that spent weeks on weeks tear gassing our most dense residential neighborhood. I heard stories of a father who is supporting me in this campaign that told me stories about how his six-month-old in their apartment was vomiting as a result of the tear gas. These are the real issues that we have to address at the police department, while also making sure that the chief law enforcement officer, who is the mayor, is giving clear directives on day one to the chief of police and to the rank and file that it is her expectation that they show up every day and do their public service. No other city employee at the city is allowed to simply say that they're not going to do their job because they disagree with the politics of their elected leaders.
When you said that you think the grants would be illegal, I mean, the city gave emergency grants to small businesses during COVID. The businesses could sign up and get thousands of dollars to help them through that time. So this isn't something that you see as comparable at all?
Those are specific dollars for economic recovery that flowed from federal dollars. This request is for city taxpayer dollars that are bound by the Washington State Constitution for security service, for private security services. So I have significant concerns about how we square this potential proposal with the state constitution.
Bruce, did you want to respond in 30 seconds?
First of all, the issues my opponent are talking about, the problems in the police department, I just have to remind our viewers that she was chair of the public safety department, the police department, for 2 years, 2018, 2019. So some of these funding issues that she's quick to point out was under her watch as chair, number one. Number two, when you openly say your goal is to defund the police department by 50%, realizing that 90% of the costs in that department are personnel related, there are going to be an aftershock of that. And one of them will be small businesses need protection and they need help. Anyone could walk around the city and see what we're talking about. And so when I talk about funding the police department, it is not to militarize communities of color. In fact, I was down at Judkins Park just 2 weeks ago with officers.
Okay, sorry, we're running out of time. Lorena, did you want to have a rebuttal on anything related to business concerns, or should we just move on?
Just really quickly, if I can, my opponent likes to point out create an inference that somehow I was committed to divesting from the police department to invest in community because I have some animus against officers. That's simply not true. I made a commitment to look at shifting dollars away from the police department in direct response to the murder of George Floyd and the action that we saw in our city. And the reason I bring up those cultural issues within the police department is because the issues of staffing have predated me, certainly, on the city council and is a national issue. And yes, we have to have a police department who is willing to show up every day and do the job. And what I'm pointing out is that there are deep cultural reform issues that cannot be simply fixed by asking them to watch videos of somebody's murder or making them sign a pledge after they sign that, after they view that video. We have to have a leader at the top who is going to make it clear that it's her expectation that these public safety employees show up every day and deliver the services that are being asked of them to deliver.
Okay, I'm going to ask
You guys keep your answers to 30 seconds just so we can get as much done as possible.
And it is really kind of a follow-up question to what you both were just talking about when it comes to police and firefighters, because it may be a budget issue that you both have to deal with. While we don't know the exact numbers until Monday, there could be a chance the city is scrambling to find even more police officers and first responders because of the vaccine mandate. Lorena, I ask the question to you first. What would you tell a potential recruit who wants to serve the city but does not want to get the shot?
I would tell that person that unfortunately the city of Seattle and Seattle Police Department is not the right department for them. I strongly believe that it is important for all of our public employees to receive the vaccine. We are one of the area's largest public employers, and there are plenty of other agencies that an individual can go look at if they're interested in doing law enforcement work but don't want to comply with their vaccine mandate.
And Bruce, I would ask you the same question and just say it a little bit differently. What do you say to the unions, police, firefighters that are reluctant to get the shot if they're interested in transferring here to the city of Seattle?
Well, I'm very proud that the firefighters have endorsed me and support my candidacy, and I will tell the firefighters or any first responders, not here in Seattle. It's a mandate. You are a first responder. I expect you to take your oath of office to the point to where you realize you have to lead with a vaccination. And so this is not the place for you here in Seattle. I'm simply put.
Bruce, thank you.
All right. This was a very fruitful discussion. I want to thank you both for your time this evening. We have run out of time. That is it for tonight's debate. We want to thank the candidates, of course, Lorena Gonzalez, as well as Bruce Harrell. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here, as well as our panelists, Amy Radill from KUOW, Daniel Beekman, Seattle Times, and Chris Daniels from King 5. Our next debate is happening in 2 weeks, October 28th at 7 o'clock, and the topic at that time will be public safety as well as public health. Until then, don't forget that Election Day is November 2nd. That means you must have your ballot postmarked by that date or in a drop box by 8 p.m. that night. Thanks for joining us. Have a good night.
Tonight's debate has come to you from the studios of KCTS 9 in Seattle. With a special thanks to the Seattle City Club's Washington State Debate Coalition in partnership with TVW, the statewide public affairs network, and KCTS 9 Crosscut. We also want to acknowledge the generous support of our many media sponsors. And our sponsors, including AARP of Seattle, Salesforce, and Tableau.
That Seattle mayoral debate between Bruce Harrell and Lorena Gonzalez just wrapping up in about an hour. King 5's Chris Daniels joining us for King 5 News.
And you have been listening to live coverage of the debate between candidates running for mayor of Seattle. I'm Lisa Brooks. Lorena Gonzalez and Bruce Harrell were passionate when they talked about zoning policies and about who is funding their campaigns. Things got heated when Gonzalez mentioned who's been paying for recent negative ads about her. She says it's coming mostly from wealthy real estate developers.
This is a reality of who my opponent is benefiting from are these billionaire class political donors, one of whom is the unrefuted top donor to the Trump campaign in 2020.
In response, Harrell wouldn't confirm or deny Gonzalez's claims, but he did make a point about where Gonzalez's money is coming from.
Jay Inslee and others that she doesn't talk about, and the fact that two-thirds of her money is coming from out of state. I mean, if we're going to have the narrative, let's just have the narrative.
And that is Lorena Gonzalez and Bruce Harrell debating just moments ago on TVW and aired right here on Cairo Radio. You will be hearing more about what the candidates had to say this evening and tomorrow morning. They focused a lot on zoning issues in the city of Seattle, and we will have that coming up after the CBS News in just a few seconds. This is Cairo Radio. I'm Lisa Brooks. The Jack Stein Show on Cairo Nights will start after this.